Welcome to this week's episode. If you thought last week was a wild ride, buckle up. Since our last broadcast, the American political landscape has shifted, or maybe more accurately, lurched. We're not just talking about your standard partisan gridlock anymore. We're talking about a fundamental challenge to the very idea of checks and balances. Remember when we were all taught in school that the Constitution was our bedrock? Yeah, that bedrock's starting to look a little cracked. We've seen actions from the executive branch that, frankly, leave us questioning whether rule of law is still in the job description. From the highly questionable arrests of Mahmoud Khalil, where due process seemed to take a sudden vacation, to the mass deportations of Venezuelan asylum seekers, where innocent until proven guilty apparently got lost in the mail, the authoritarian playbook is no longer just a history lesson. It's playing out in real time, right here, right now. And let's be real, folks, if they can do it to them, they can do it to anyone. We're not saying the sky is falling, but we are suggesting you grab an umbrella and maybe a copy of the Bill of Rights just in case. It's Monday, March 24th, 2025. I'm your host, Niels Olson, and let's face it, folks, the news cycle is currently performing a high wire act over a flaming garbage heap. We're here to grab the fire extinguisher and sift through the, shall we say, crispy remains for some actual truth. This week's episode is a bit of a departure. My partner in defiance is taking a well-deserved breather to handle some real-world responsibilities. You know, the kind that don't involve deciphering political doublespeak. So, for moral support and fact-checking backup, I've conscripted our intrepid research assistant, Jack, in the studio. And later, we'll be joined by our friend and contributor, Turbo, who will dive deeper into the chaos with us as we talk about privacy and personal security. As always, you can join us at criticaldefiance.com. Sign up for our newsletter, we promise. It's less flammable than the current headlines. And don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Hit that like button like it owes you money, and share the word. If you're feeling particularly generous and want to fuel our truth-seeking endeavors, you can toss us a virtual coffee at buymeacoffee.com/criticaldefiance. Every little bit helps us keep the lights on and the fire metaphors burning. All right, let's get to the news. So getting into the news, we've got to start last Saturday. President Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act from 1798 to give the executive branch the power to deport people without due process who are deemed alien enemies. The last time this was invoked, just to put it in perspective, was during World War II when we started putting Japanese Americans in camps for being potentially Japanese sympathizers. I'm not happy about this. Most of America isn't. It's a little bit scary. And the first thing they did was round up over 200 Venezuelans that they claim are gang members. They deported these people without any due process, any hearings before a judge, anything. They just put them on a plane and sent them straight to a prison for gang members in El Salvador. How does this sound to you, Turbo? Like, is this a little bit much for America, or is it just me? This is a little weird, right?
This sounds very weird and extreme. Because what's the definition of the threat to society? What is an alien enemy? And who really is an enemy alien at this point? It sounds very un-American sending people to camps, whether they're domestic or abroad. But it sounds like we're just shipping people to labor camps with more stuff since it's across international borders.
Only this country would come up with a way to offshore the concentration camps, you know? Like, that's a little bit crazy.
Especially since we don't really know all that much from these people being lifted. I doubt most of them are gang members. Aren't they Venezuelan? Why are they being sent to El Salvador?
It's the prison we chose that charges us a couple dollars a day for each inmate, because we're actually paying for this with your tax dollars.
That is absolute insanity.
So we've got this system in place now where they declare an alien enemy, they pick them up off the street, they disappear them, they land in El Salvador, and poof, they're gone. Now, what makes the story scarier is a federal judge ordered a halt to it and said, if the planes are in the air, turn them around, bring them back. These people are entitled to due process. This is America. And they ignored him. Now, we're still light on details as specifically who made the decision and why, but they are defending that decision to the point that the Justice Department is asserting that selecting who alien enemies are is a presidential prerogative, and they're playing with invoking national security so they don't have to give the judge information on who they deported. You take that in one hand, and then in the other hand, you pick up the fact that the families and friends of these people who have been deported are telling us they've been deported for things like having tattoos that were similar to gang tattoos. And they're not disclosing any information about these criminal gang members to the public or the courts. I'm super suspicious, right?
That sounds like a shadowy government entity disappearing people off of the streets. Plain and simple.
Yeah, and this guy's only been in office for a couple months.
Yeah.
I think what we're seeing here with these deportees is a test case. He's trying to say, okay, these gang members are effectively invading the country, therefore I can treat them as alien enemies and do whatever I want with them. And I'm going to deport them, send them to a labor camp in El Salvador. Let's see how the public reacts. I think that's the stage we're at. They're testing to see what they can get away with. I think they want to see what they can get away with in court, disobeying the courts, and in terms of public opinion.
I would definitely agree. It sounds like they're testing the waters. It's a small batch of people from a country most Americans don't know, being sent to an even more obscure one that people know even less about.
So, yeah, which is sort of the American way lately under Trump. That's you know, ignorance is bliss, I guess. Now, the other thing that happened in terms of immigration over the last couple of days, over this weekend, Trump has revoked the status of over 500,000 people from multiple countries, Haiti, Cuba, parts of Latin America. He's creating criminal immigrants to deport now. They couldn't find enough criminal gang members, and they're not getting away with pulling the Alien Enemies Act stuff as cleanly as they thought they would. So now they're just going to criminalize people who used to be here with our permission. This is insane. It is just racism that I can't tolerate anymore. There's so much going on here, but all of it comes down to racism. It's blowing my mind, and it's happening right in front of our eyes.
I think we've become desensitized to a lot of these things. Seeing all of these armored and militarized police clashes with people, we already know what kind of resistance they're going to throw at us.
And then there's overt messages too, like they tore up Black Lives Matter Plaza in D.C. That's a pretty direct slap in the face. That's not hiding it anymore. That is not hiding it anymore. And, you know, you take that, you look at where it trickles out to, and you see how we're handling Palestine, and we see how they're dealing with people who are protesting about it, and that shit's gone cold and crazy too. There's this extreme focus on protesters and protest groups that are quote-unquote anti-Semitic, and really what they're doing is calling out anybody who thinks that genocide shouldn't be going on in that part of the world right now. It's a little fucked up.
Yeah, and especially with the way that they're straight up calling these things illegal, I can definitely see something worse than the Kent State issue.
They want to make people afraid to protest. They've been going after people just for taking a stance that isn't the same as the regime's. That's some chilling shit, and they're trying to make examples of them so that other students and other protesters don't stand up. And we're hitting a stage in this fight where we just can't let them win anymore. We just can't let them continue to do this. Because if we do, they're going to be ruling this country with an iron fist. And we are all going to be living under somebody's boot heel. So it's time to really look at what's going on out there, guys, with the way they're handling protesters, with the way they're handling immigrants. Because it could be any of us next. It's not isolated just to the people you don't like. It could be any of them.
Is being actively denied in front of our faces, despite the evidence saying otherwise everywhere.
Yeah. Orwell, We're going straight into Orwell. And that's going to be a lot of what we talk about in the second half of this episode, is the Big Brother side of Orwell. So stay tuned for that. It's really disheartening to see the direction that this regime is going in and the fact that they're pushing for the authoritarian angle. And that's really what I want everybody to look at. Do we want to be North Korea or Russia or China? Or do we want to be America? Because I think that's the crossroads we're at right now. I look at other things they're doing too. We've got some changes going on at the Social Security Administration. These guys, they're ending phone service for Social Security and switching everything to online or in-person only. And what I want to know is, what 75-year-old is going to be able to get into the car and drive to a Social Security office? Oh, I don't know, 40 minutes away because they closed half of them? Or know how to do this online? Ending phone service is not a cost-cutting maneuver. Ending phone service is a way for them to get people off the rolls and save money so they can give more tax cuts to the frickin' billionaires. To add insult to injury, the Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, turned around this week and suggested that only fraudsters would complain about missing a Social Security check, and that most people wouldn't mind if the government simply skipped a payment. Is this man out of his mind? Are these people really that out of touch with the rest of us? Like, have we hit that stage where just our elected officials and our appointed officials live in a different reality than we do?
I don't think these people understand even the basic cost of the loaf of bread or why the cost of eggs is important. Food security is a big thing. And most people are using these things to either feed themselves or get housing, both of which most elected officials haven't struggled with in, I don't know, most of their lives. Yeah. So, you know, they are out of touch with most constituents. Everybody that I know who knows other people, so on and so forth, that it's just not enough anymore in terms of no matter what anybody's making. Doctors are struggling. Yeah. Lawyers are struggling to feed themselves and pay their bills. Everything that is stereotypically and traditionally the well-off, wealthy, rich people things.
You know, we live in a world where college has effectively become high school. The job market is a whole other beast than it was even 10 or 20 years ago, let alone 50. And the expectation is that you're supposed to live the American dream with diminished resources, diminished opportunity, and under the boot heel. I don't get how we're supposed to pull it off, and I'm beginning to wonder if we're even expected to, or if it's just an illusion they wave in front of our face to make us keep going. The new Department of Education feels that we should really only be teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic in this country. And I thought about that for a minute, and it made perfect sense to me. It's just the things you need to work. It's exactly what you need to be a good peasant in our new techno-feudal society.
Yeah, it circles around to everybody's favorite talking point that most schools were not made for actual education. It was to, you know, get you used to the 9 to 5 or however much longer of working inside of factories. Mm-hmm.
As much or more about indoctrination.
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing Linda McMahon take tombstone pile drivers from a mayor in Tennessee. The world is a weird place.
Yeah, like,
I remember when
seriously?
She was pretending to be quadriplegic because of her injuries on pretty much what is a man-on-man soap opera in English. It's soap opera with more leotards. So, you know, there's with that, especially, I won't get into all the business practices, but look into how wrestling actually operates as an industry. That talent is not treated well, I'll just tell you that much.
All right. There's one more thing I wanted to talk about, and I thought you would be great for this conversation, but there's one more place that I wanted us to go in the news, and I wanted to keep the news short this week because we've got a lot of talked about in the discussions. What is with the special status of Tesla in the United States now? Tesla is, what, a protected entity now?
Apparently.
Or is Tesla just better than us?
I really don't understand. It's very heavy-fisted, iron-fisted. Just declaring that individual company and protesting is domestic terrorism. There's a lot of other things that I've witnessed in the last 6 years that would definitely be considered domestic terrorism. School shootings, first and foremost. Kids can get blown apart, but everybody just
says... The penalty for defacing a Tesla is now higher than shooting up a school. The president is declaring any action against Tesla to be domestic terrorism and has instructed the DOJ to treat it as such. Pam Bondi over the DOJ is threatening the public over protesting Tesla or defacing a Tesla or otherwise harming a Tesla. It's gotten crazy. The message is clear. Tesla is better than us. They're more important than us. And our opinions of them don't count because they are special and protected.
Yeah, apparently the Constitution does not apply in terms of Tesla, which is very strange.
All right, so that was a brief look back at the news of the last week. You're listening to Critical Defiance, and let's be honest, sometimes you need to wear your defiance on your sleeve or your coffee mug. That's where our merch store comes in. Head over to criticaldefiance.com and snag some gear that screams, "I'm woke and I've got the receipts to prove it." We've got everything from our classic logo tees to mugs that'll make your morning coffee a little less soul-crushing. Because if you're going to fight the good fight, you might as well look good doing it, right? Every purchase helps support the podcast. So go check it out. That's criticaldefiance.com. In today's digital age, personal privacy and security aren't just conveniences, they're fundamental necessities. This is even more important when living under an authoritarian regime. Imagine a world where every online search, every private message, every financial transaction, and even your physical location is constantly monitored. That's the reality for many already throughout the world. Without robust privacy measures, your every move, every shared thought, might one day soon be tracked and used against you. It could happen at any time, and it might already be happening here in America. Authoritarian governments often leverage surveillance to maintain control. They tend to start by using data to identify dissenters, silence opposition, and suppress freedom of expression. In these kinds of regimes, your private information could one day be weaponized to intimidate, blackmail, or even imprison you or your loved ones. Simply possessing information deemed subversive might also lead to severe consequences. During the Cold War, for instance, the fear of communist infiltration led to widespread investigations and accusations of subversion. Information considered to be communist propaganda, aka any dissenting viewpoint against the government, was often labeled as subversive. The risks aren't just limited to political persecution. Your financial security is also at stake. Without encryption and secure practices, your accounts can be compromised, leading to identity theft and financial ruin. Your personal health information, intimate relationships, and even your daily routines can become vulnerable to exploitation as well. In highly scrutinized environments, anonymity becomes a shield. Encrypted communication platforms, virtual private networks, and secure browsing habits are not just tech tools, they're lifelines. They allow you to communicate safely, access uncensored information, and organize without fear. Protecting your digital footprint becomes a way of protecting your very existence. Remember, privacy is not about hiding something. It's about protecting everything. It's about safeguarding your autonomy, your dignity, and your fundamental right to live without constant fear of judgment by outsiders. In a world where information is power and the internet is inescapable, protecting your privacy is your most powerful preemptive defense. All right, guys, today Turbo's flipping the script and putting me in the hot seat. We're tackling the wild world of digital privacy and security, a topic which I know a little bit about because I've been in IT for most of my life. We're going to talk about the things that show up in our lives. So, for instance, think of that creepy feeling when your phone totally knows that you need new socks, but on a scale that could influence elections. We'll be breaking down how your data is being used, who's watching, and what you can do to reclaim some semblance of control. So, grab your tinfoil hats or just your regular headphones and let's get into it. Turbo, all you.
All right. So I want to start with the initial creepy, skeevy, definitely big invasions of privacy. things like data harvesting, data mining, and data aggregation, and what the differences are.
All right, so data harvesting is something that happens to all of us all the time. You browse the internet, you browse social media, you use apps on your phone, and you generate data. The data is things like what you've looked at, how long you've looked at it. Did you share it with anyone? Did you click a link and go somewhere or make a purchase? This is all data that gets harvested, usually with your permission. And that's something that most people don't catch because none of us really read the terms of service or the end user license agreement.
Most of the time, no.
No, most of us don't. But when you look at them, what you find is that those types of actions and other basic data about your use of pretty much anything from a website to a search engine to an app on your phone can and will be used and repurposed. So that's data harvesting. They're basically taking the data that you're generating using their product. Okay, let's take Google as an example. Google harvests data from your searches. You go to Google, you search, you do it all the time. You do it 10 times a day some days. You do it at work, you do it at home, you do it on your phone, you do it on your computer, you do it on your tablet. It's a part of your life. They harvest that data. They keep a record of your searches. They use that to profile you. They use it to determine what types of ads to show you. And in some cases, depending on who you're dealing with, they sell that data to other parties. And that's really common. So that's data harvesting. Does that make sense, Turbo?
When I was in college, we had a marketing class that touched on something like this. The creepy predictive system that I believe Target used was telling women they were pregnant before they knew, based on the things they were looking at buying. Like, they started suggesting maternity things before these women knew they were pregnant. And this was, like, in the early 2000s, these studies were coming from.
Yeah. So you had also asked about data mining. Data mining is when you actively go out to get the data. Data mining can also be called, in most cases, investigation. Data mining is done in a variety of different ways. One of the most common ones is to use bots or automated systems that crawl around the internet, look for selective data, and report it to home. So data mining is a way of going out and seeking data, where data harvesting is grabbing the data that flows by. Does that make sense as a distinction?
Harvesting is more eavesdropping, where a miner would be hiring a private detective.
Yes. Yes. And then we talked about data aggregation, right? You had asked about aggregation. Yeah. And aggregation is basically the fancy term for taking all of that data and putting it together. So there are firms and services that do this. They take the data that's been collected through harvesting or mining. They take the data you've volunteered in places like your social media bio and public posts, and they put it all together to make a profile on you. So that's data aggregation.
And I guess that starts coming into terms like data brokers who buy and sell that data.
Yep. Their whole job is to collect and aggregate data and then sell it to the highest bidder for a variety of reasons, primarily marketing. But it's not just advertising. That can also be political research. So, yeah, there's profile data about all of this out there based on what we do in public. And it winds up in the hands of data brokers who buy and sell it all the time. If you Google your own name right now, you will probably get results from a number of data brokers that, for a fee, will tell anybody where you live, who you live with, how long you've been there, what your previous addresses are, any current or past phone numbers, and in some cases, email addresses, and very often, for an additional fee, any public records that mention your name. And a lot of people don't even realize that this is going on. But seriously, if you want to see just how deep it runs, try Googling yourself. It can be a very interesting experience. Now, we talked about data brokers, and I just want to throw something in here. There's a creepier thing in the world. A lot of folks don't realize that there's such a thing as private intelligence firms. There are privately held intelligence interests throughout the world, a number of them in this country, whose job it is to do all of this, harvest, mine, aggregate, and then ultimately analyze everything, so that they can answer questions of agencies like the CIA or the FBI or the highest bidder.
That's nefarious.
It's creepy, right?
That is very creepy.
And we can talk about where they get it. where they get it primarily is your social media, folks. They can track your internet activity through a whole variety of means. They can use intercepts on your communications, actual wiretaps if it's a government or a bad actor. But really, the truth is, most of the data they gather about the average person is volunteered on social media. See, the thing is, when you're on social media sites, you're creating this broad overview of you, your life, your interests, and who you're interacting with in public. And that's the thing you have to remember, guys. When you're online, you are in public. I don't care if you're sitting home. The internet is a public place.
So does that really work like the photography laws? If you're in an open space, people don't need your permission to photograph you. So that's why they can get away with that.
For the most part, people don't need your permission to read your content that you have made publicly available. Courts typically view that as broadcasting your information as opposed to sharing it.
Yeah, because it wouldn't get there any other way.
Right.
It's essentially just a forum. Yeah, I could see that.
Most people put out so much information about themselves and don't realize it. They do it in tiny little chunks, a little bit here, a little bit there, post here, comment there, check in here.
What are ways to prevent these people from getting my data or any steps or things I can do to help make them have a tougher time reading me?
I think where I would start for most people, and I know it's going to sound like silly, common stuff that you've heard and been beat over the head with 1,000 times, but make sure your passwords are good. Make sure you've got really solid passwords, passwords that can't be guessed. That means no personal information in them. That means no names in them. That means no birthdays in them, no significant numbers. You want stuff that's as close to random as you can possibly get. You can make it memorable by using combinations of words that you normally wouldn't. Or you can do what a lot of us do nowadays and get a password manager. And there are some really good ones out there. There are even a couple good free ones out there. What a password manager does is eliminate the most common problem that people have that causes them to make weak passwords. It will save all of your passwords. It will store them in a secure fashion. And then when you need to enter them, it will do it for you. The only thing that you have to do is remember one password to lock and unlock it. So you've sort of got this vault or key ring that automatically does it for you, as long as you remember one good password. Most of these pieces of software do a great job at generating really hard to break passwords for them to store. So seriously, think about getting yourself a password manager. And I think along with the password manager, use two-factor authentication whenever you can. Anytime that you're dealing with banking data, personal or privileged information, health information, anything that you want to make hard for hackers to get their hands on, turn on two-factor or what they sometimes call multi-factor authentication. An example of this is most banks. You log in with your password, they send a text message to your phone with a 6-digit number, and you key that in. The reason that you're doing that, just so you understand it, is to make it vastly harder for someone to steal your credentials. Now, instead of just asking for your password, we're asking for something you physically have as well, your phone in this case. And without getting access to that phone, somebody who's stolen your password can't get in. So that's why it's done, and that's why we recommend it. I think that's a big one. Start there. Good passwords, password manager, and use two-factor wherever you can. I think the next place to go, probably communications, right, Turba? Because that's a big part of everybody's lives.
We mentioned it earlier. We are still dealing with modern-day wiretaps, but now everything's digital, so they don't even need to be in the same room to do it.
It's vastly easier.
Definitely a good place to start.
All right, so if we start with that premise that getting a hold or intercepting somebody's communications is easier nowadays because of the distributed nature of everything, then what we need to look at is how do we make that harder? Most people message on their phones constantly. It's a primary form of communications for a lot of us nowadays. And most people are using either SMS messaging or MMS messaging, what we call text messaging.
newer phones, iPhones use iMessage, and Android phones use something called RCS. The older systems, SMS and MMS, they're not encrypted. So everything in the network gets to see what your messages are. And I can guarantee there are copies stored on your carrier's server in a backup for a very long time. Generally, you can't delete those, by the way, guys. RCS and iMessage have the advantage of being encrypted when they're talking to people who are using the same product. So when you speak to someone who is also using iMessage, your messaging is encrypted end-to-end from your end to their end and vice versa. When you use RCS and Android, same thing. When you start talking Android to iPhone or iPhone to Android, chances are your communication will not be encrypted. So you want a secure messaging platform. You want something that's end-to-end encrypted, something that both parties are using to make sure that anybody in the middle can't just read those messages or store them for later. I tend to recommend Signal. It is one of my favorite messaging products. It combines simple messaging with calling that includes group calling and group messaging. So it's a pretty straightforward app. It's just like your iMessage, your RCS, your text messaging. But from end to end, it is completely encrypted so that anybody who intercepts it, scans it, sees it, or otherwise gets a copy of it has no idea what's inside. You need that. In a world where we don't know how authoritarian the government's going to get, you need that. And you need my other favorite thing, which is encrypted email. Who do you use for email, Turbo?
I use Proton. Most people have never heard of it. I definitely get some looks when that cashier asks you for your email address at the store.
I use Proton as well. Proton is an encrypted email service. So Proton does for email what a good encrypted messaging app like Signal or Wire can do for your messages. Proton is one of the email providers out there. We love them. We recommend them. Full disclosure, I do believe we refer them, so we probably get a piece if you click the link in the episode notes. They're not the only one out there, though. There's a few others, and if you do a Google search for encrypted email services or secure email services, you'll find, well, I think it's about 15 of them now, that provide encrypted email, but you've got to keep in mind, encrypted email is only encrypted when both parties are using an encrypted email service. So if your mom, without encryption, sends you a message, you don't have any extra security, really. But if Turbo and I were to email each other, both being on Proton, it is thoroughly encrypted, and we love that. Email is essentially a postcard. Without encryption, where it's coming from, where it's going to, and what the message is visible to parties in the middle. With encryption, you stick it in an envelope and solve that problem. All right, so what are some other things we can talk about in terms of practical steps, Turbo? Give me some ideas. What do you
want to know? What outside of browser settings and app settings can we do?
Real world, real life, IRL?
Yeah, maybe something I can do or start changing in behaviors or mannerisms or something like that.
Okay, so like actual real world IRL stuff. The first one I'm going to put out there is get notebooks. I love notes. I love taking notes on my computer. I use a computer with a touchscreen and a pen. I love using that. And on that, I use an encrypted notes program. But when I want something to be really secure, I put it on paper in a notebook in my corner of the underground bunker. And the only way you're going to get to that is if you come in and steal it. So I don't have to worry about my notebooks being hacked. Can't hack a notebook. Can't hack paper. So the most secure stuff that I need, it gets written in a notebook. Not on my computers. Not on my tablet. Not on my phone. In fact, I have a little one that I carry with me for really important stuff, just in case. It's got its own little slot for a pen. So yeah, carry a notebook, guys. All right, Turbo. So I think what we've learned today, since we're coming up on time, is this is a big topic. I think this is something we've got to come back to. There's other things I'd love to talk about. I want to talk about search privacy, browsing privacy in more detail. I think we could get in hardware settings too, like things you can do with your phone and your computer to make them a little bit harder to get into or to scrape data from. Why don't we look for a date where we can do part two and give the audience some more detail?
Sure. Yeah. We could talk longer on this. There's no one simple way to condense it all. I have no problems continuing this conversation at a later date.
All right, folks, that's a wrap for this week's Critical Defiance. But it's to be continued. I'm really looking forward to getting back into the topic of personal security and privacy with Turbo, and we'll probably do that after next week's special episode that's kind of a surprise. In the meantime, we're going to leave you with some links and resources in the show notes that you can use to do a little bit of your own homework and learn more about the topic yourselves. Don't be a stranger. Hit that subscription button on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcast fix. And while you're at it, head over to criticaldefiance.com for show notes, bonus content, and to sign up for our newsletter, because your inbox deserves some quality content too. Give us a like on Facebook or find us on Blue Sky if you're into that sort of thing. I also want to give a huge shout out to Turbo for stepping up and filling in for Bobby today. You crushed it. Thank you. And until next time, this is Niels Olsen signing off. Stay informed, stay engaged, and keep the spirit of democracy alive.